We're back together again, you and I, chatting it up Wednesday style, midweek, October 29th, 2025, on Connecticut Today, where I open the show wondering, in light of some new evidence, if state agencies hold any culpability in connection with the death of 11-year-old Mimi Garcia months ago due to alleged neglect. CBS News legal analyst Thane Rosenbaum dropped by to talk about the legal implications surrounding a call for President Trump to release federal SNAP benefits by using something called the Administrative Procedures Act. Yankee Institute for Public Policy fellow Frank Ricci joined us on the current state employee contract talks with the governor's office. And finally, Hearst Connecticut Media senior editor and columnist Dan Haar stopped by. We chatted about the state's Public Utilities Regulatory Authority as well as state and national politics surrounding SNAP benefits. So late last night, well after we wrapped up the festivities for Tuesday's Connecticut Today, couple of stories broke around the state, and it's kind of one of the things that we were waiting for, and everybody has been waiting for more information in connection with the tragic death, the alleged starvation and malnutrition and neglect death months and months ago, allegedly, of an 11-year-old girl, Mimi Garcia, in New Britain. Her mother, the mother's boyfriend, and the mother's sister, the aunt, are all being held now on some pretty serious child neglect charges and all that. And we were all wondering, when stuff like this happens and you have this story, and even you go back to the Waterbury case of, what, about 7 or 8 months ago, a gentleman now in his early 30s, we're told, identified only as S, claims that he was imprisoned in his home by his stepmother ever since, she said, when the boy was just 12, when this man was just 12. He's now in his early 30s. So some 20 years ago when he allegedly was taken out of school to be homeschooled. You know, you wonder, and we're all waiting, like, what did people know? What did the police know? And you ask yourselves, how could this happen? How could this happen with the all the state agencies, with various levels of law enforcement, with local police, with state police, with DCF, with Child Protective Services, with all kinds of levels of stuff that is supposed to happen here to sniff this out before it gets to nearly a tragic end with this young man, and definitely a tragic end with a little 11-year-old Mimi Garcia. So last night, a couple of outlets, including NBC Connecticut Channel 30, started to release some information that they had found through DCF. And the question begs right now as we get into this, and I'll start this off today because, you know, what do you do here? And my question is this, and we'll go over some of this evidence in case you haven't seen the story. You were up, maybe you went to bed early last night, didn't see the news, or didn't catch up with it today. My question is, what culpability do you think state agencies have in the alleged starvation death of 11-year-old Mimi Garcia in New Britain? Now, when I ask it that way, I don't mean to say there was anybody, any decent or mindful worker, a Connecticut State Union person who said, "We want the girl to die." Of course not. That's not what I'm aiming at here. But again, we've talked about it on this show. Lisa has. Melissa has. I'm sure the weekend people have touched on it too. This case, another case like it, I think a couple of years ago. And also the case of that young Waterbury man. People say, how could this happen? And, of course, legislators on both sides of the aisle scream and yell in Hartford as well. They should. This is something I think that they can get together on and say, hey, we have thousands and thousands and thousands of relatively well-paid state employees. How does this happen? So when we come back, I've got some information here that you see and hear. And you, part of you is going to say, well, there it is. Why didn't they react to that? And then part of you is probably going to say, well, hey, wait a minute. How do they know it would get to the level of the brutal and hellish alleged starvation and neglect death for an 11-year-old going on 12-year-old girl? It is mind-numbing. But you know enough about the case. We'll come back a little in a few seconds here and talk about the new information that's been released along with some video. But the question remains, what culpability do you think? And this will be a long investigation. And remember, we have three suspects in this case. But what culpability do you out there think that state agencies, maybe police, DCF, whatever, Board of Ed, State Board of Ed, what culpability do these agencies have in the alleged starvation death and neglect death of 11-year-old Mimi Garcia in New Britain? And by the way, if you have been involved with child protective cases, maybe you've made complaints, maybe you're the subject of a complaint, maybe you called in a complaint, 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. If you don't want to talk, if you don't want to be on the air, you can text me something in confidence, and I will not say from whom or where it came from. All right, we're getting more now on a story that kind of was in neutral. We weren't really hearing too much more about any further developments in connection with the alleged. And I say alleged. We all know what happened, but just it's legal. Legally, it makes everybody safer when you say what the prosecutors say, when you say what the police say. So we're just being safe here. The apparent but alleged starvation and neglect death of the 11-year-old girl, Mimi Garcia. Pulling this, and I think Melissa talked about this earlier today as well. This was posted late last night, Tuesday night, just before 11:30, so you may not have seen or heard this. And the reason I'm going to talk about this is when you hear these reports, and you kind of knew what was going to happen because they talked to caseworkers, I'm sure the Attorney General's office, I'm sure the State Prosecutor office, I'm sure the State Police office, they all send inspectors and folks and officers to reconstruct what the deal is here whenever you have, tragically, what happened both to this young man, the S, as he calls himself, recovering from the alleged Shelton home imprisonment, and the death of Mimi Garcia. And apparently Channel 30 has done some digging, and some other folks have dug, too. And they say they've learned details of three potentially key interactions with DCF since last August when flags were raised. Now, before we get to those, they do report that many people involved in the case are now bound to retrace the steps. In other words, here's what happened. Let's go in reverse. How did we miss that? Now, NBC Connecticut is reporting that warrants in the case have been unsealed, and also interactions with police, child welfare workers that Mimi's family had, which other folks didn't know about. Now, again, the best estimate based on court documents, they say, is that Mimi Garcia passed away sometime in September of 2024, although the remains were only found earlier this month. Now, NBC is reporting that court and police documents they found show police were called out to Mimi's Farmington home four times from last September through this February. They were all noise related. So the first time was September 28th. That, they say, could have possibly been just days after Mimi Garcia died. Now, they report that it's been believed that during the time that Mimi's body was in the basement, it was causing an odor, police did not note anything unusual. So, again, if the timeline is accurate here, NBC Connecticut Channel 30 is investigating here, had they maybe snooped around, maybe they would have jumped onto something a little earlier. Now, there were other interactions with DCF, although the interactions apparently in the timeline likely came possibly after the girl's death. They report, number one, a neighbor contacted DCF out of concerns that Mimi's younger sister was carrying heavy groceries and garbage bags and would go out in the cold to start the family car. Another neighbor of Mimi's was an elementary school teacher in New Britain where Mimi's sister attended classes. They also report here that the neighbor told police DCF was contacted more than once after Mimi's sister, not Mimi, came to school with bruises. And Mimi's father told police that when Mimi's mother would not share her address with him so he could see her, he says he called DCF, which apparently said it could not do a wellness check on Mimi since her father did not know where they lived. So DCF has had no comment at this time. Now, again, we're not doing this to finger anybody, to put a thumb in people's eyes. But again, kudos to Channel 30 and other people who are looking into this. And look, I've spoken with people over the years who work for DCF. DCF is always a vastly underfunded and understaffed agency. So we'll see. But what do you think of this? And we're not here to, I don't ask this question to beat on anybody who's a child welfare worker here in Connecticut. Listen. Devious mothers and fathers, whether that's the biological sense or not, will and can and will always hide stuff. They just will. But do you think there's any culpability for, sadly, what happened to Mimi Garcia by the state? And maybe DCF or state agencies or the school? I don't know. I'm just asking. I'm not out to bury anybody here. Let's start it off today with Paul in Bethel. Paul, you're on WICC. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good, Paul. How are you?
I'm up. I'm good, Paul. What's going on?
Yeah, I'm not seeing culpability here. You know, how many thousands of families does DCF have to deal with every year? And we've got, obviously, tragic. We've got this case and the Waterbury case.
Yeah.
That slipped through the cracks. There is no way you're going to get a zero slip through the crack.
Yep.
It's never going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So all they can do is try to fine-tune, try to figure out what they're doing, which it sounds like what they're doing. But then, you know, if you get too much, then you're going to get screaming about civil liberties and you
yep.
can't do this. And so where are you? You're nowhere. You're in the middle, and DCF is stuck in the middle, and they're doing all they can with the limited funds and the limited manpower and all that. It's just tough, and I don't know where you go from there.
Yeah, you know Paul, it's kind of like it's kind of like maybe you add layers to it. What do they say when it's cold? Dress in layers. You know, three or four jackets, even if they're not heavy, are going to keep you warmer than maybe one heavy jacket. So maybe, Paul, you're right. Something. Sadly, there are always going to be cracks there, right? How do we make it more difficult for stuff to get through the cracks, right?
It's a constant effort. It's like constantly trying to improve your employees at work. It's not one day everything's better. No, it's not going to work that way.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a lot of talk about that they had somebody stand in as the 12-year-old
yeah.
for a conversation. So what do you do with that? Well, before we have the conversation, we have to fingerprint that person, or do we have to do a DNA test on that person?
Yeah.
It doesn't end. So it's, you do all you can do, and people are people. You know, people can make mistakes on DCF, and there's a lot of people making mistakes out there in the world.
And also, Paul, thank you. Appreciate the call. Also, maybe not so much mistakes in DCF. Maybe they say, hey, listen, I'm a caseworker here. I did what I always do in these cases. I've sniffed out horrible stuff like this, and we got to it early enough. But again, all those people at DCF who do a great job, they're overtaxed, they're underpaid, they're understaffed. You know, they're always, unfortunately, they will always be dealing with a certain percentage of mutant, deviant, so-called parents in the world. All right, we have a guest coming up. First of all, listen very closely. All right, turn this up. Do you hear this? You hear that? Here it is again. A listener dropped this off at the radio station for me today. I'll tell you what that is. One more. If you hear me talk about my sports fandom, you'll know what that is. All right. 203-333-9422-333-WICC. The clock ticking toward perhaps the cessation, although hopefully if it happens, it'll be brief rather than long, of SNAP benefits. Now, the opposition to the White House is saying, hey, the president doesn't have to do this. There's something called the Administrative Procedures Act. A dummy like me is not going to be able to describe that to you and why the Democrats say the president should use that and why Republicans say he should not or he can't. So we go to one of our legal eagles, a well-known CBS News legal analyst, Thane Rosenbaum, to hopefully set me straight on this. Thane, it's Paul. Good afternoon. How are you, sir?
Great hearing your voice, buddy. I'm taking a guess.
Yeah.
I don't know about your fanhood.
Okay.
Fandom.
Yeah.
But, bag of money?
No. Thane, from your lips to God's ears. No,
I was gonna say, I wish I had listeners like that.
No, no. I'll have the once we end this, I'll have I'll have the desk at CBS tell you. All right, Thane.
Right.
All of a sudden now we're seeing, well, this is unnecessary because of something called the Administrative Procedures Act. What is that?
So, you know, look, we have a large bureaucracy of a regulatory environment that covers all kinds of benefits and congressional spending.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever there's a question of, you know, some dispute as to how those funds get allocated or whether there's enough of them,
yeah,
or frankly, anything that has to do with the federal bureaucracy, the Minister of Procedure Act has their options within them that can trigger certain kinds of review that would otherwise not be there,
mm-hmm.
right? Other options, other reviews, other possibilities, other hearings that are required before, in a case like this, money stops, right?
Yeah.
Where the procedure itself steps in and says, Well, wait a minute. There may be another way of looking at this, or there if it's available, if Administrative Procedure Act is available. It just so happens under the United States Department of Agriculture, which is what the SNAP benefits come from,
mm-hmm.
the Administrative Procedure Act actually is available.
Wow.
And that just happens to be a loophole that creates another option. And in the Administrative Procedure Act, in this case, triggers additional funding, substantial amount of funding that can be allocated, even if the primary funding stops. So everyone should be saying, wow, that's great, you know, except that the position that the United States Department of Agriculture is saying, yeah, but the Administrative Procedure Act only works in this case if there's a natural disaster, right?
Okay.
Like if there's a hurricane,
yeah,
or if there's a tornado, or if something terrible happens, that is where the Administrative Procedure Act opens up the opportunity for additional funding, but not in the ordinary sense here, where there's no, it's just the government is coming to a shutdown and benefits are being stopped. So that sounds like a very legalistic way of looking at it. And so you can imagine why the 25 state attorneys general that are suing the government and why some congresspersons are saying, well, wait a minute, the Administrative Procedure Act is available. Why not use it? That's what's going to be the dispute now. Can they use it when, in fact, the bureaucracy is basically saying, yeah, but we're only allowed to use it under specific guidelines, and those are not present in the situation.
So finally, Thane, so could this, I mean, we're at almost 4 o'clock here Eastern time, you know, 2 days out. Could we see this going to a court tonight, tomorrow, Friday? Is there any way that people who say this should be used can go to a court here or not?
Yeah, and, you know, it could either go to an administrative proceeding, which is a court that's under the executive branch, or into the federal court system where you're seeking emergency review. In this case, right, it's clearly emergency review because the funding is coming to an end. So, yes, that's a possibility. Or, one could imagine President Trump stepping in and saying, either by executive order or some other way, saying to, remember, the United States, it's a federal agency, and he has his own cabinet official who's associated with the Department of Agriculture.
He says,
I'm the President of the United States. I'm telling you to tap into those funds. I'm directing you to tap into those funds, even though the person who's the administrator who's there saying, not under those circumstances, the president is stepping in and saying, make it available.
So you're saying, Thane, finally, that if he wanted to, he could look like a hero here. He could.
And, you know, President Trump likes that.
I'm shocked.
He likes that look.
I'm shocked, yeah. Check it out, ThaneRosenbaum.com. All right, Thane, I'll tell you what it is. I'm a New York Jets fan, okay? So that, you know, all right? And I always talking about, you know, listen, it's the weekend coming up now. They're off this weekend. Thankfully, we got win number one last week. So I said, listen, I've got to break out, you know, the Tums, the Rolaids, whatever. And I cap it off with something called, now you may have heard it, being a New Yorker, brioski. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
It's basically a thing, if you go online, B-R-I-O-S-C-H-I, it's Italian Alka-Seltzer. That's what it is. And my father used to sell it in a store, and it's actually, so one of my great listeners dropped it off because he knows the agita that I get watching my beloved New York Jets.
And was that the fizz?
I'm shaking it in the, so essentially it's Italian Alka-Seltzer with the lemon flavor and everything. So there you go.
And it works.
Yes, we're now 1-7 or 1-8, whatever, and we're fine. All right, Thane Rosenbaum. Hey, Thane, great to chat with you as usual.
Anytime,
and we'll
buddy.
Keep in touch
Thanks,
on this.
Paul.
Thanks, Thane. Appreciate it. And we welcome back here to WICC a gentleman who's been on with us before, Connecticut resident. He is a labor fellow, or the labor fellow, of the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, former City of New Haven employee, of course, involved in a very, very, very famous legal case, made it all the way up to the Supreme Court, Ritchie versus DeStefano, and Frank's going to chat about what he hears and sees regarding state employee labor contract negotiations with the governor, Ned Lamont, who is heading into, of course, a suspected, now he hasn't said he's running yet, technically stretching this out, I understand why, a suspected reelection. Hey, Frank, it's Paul again. Good afternoon. How are you?
Paul, honor to be on your show.
Thank you, Frank. So you're the one that says it's an honor. I knew I'd find somebody. All right, Frank. So what are we looking at here? There are a number of state unions. CBAC, I guess, is the bargaining coalition here. They expect stuff from the governor's office. Frank, they controlled a lot of votes. But the governor has said, Frank, if I remember correctly, he said, well, you know, I'm going to try, but you're probably not going to get everything you want. So where do we stand on this?
Well, all the governors always say you're not going to get everything you want, but it seems that they just keep giving away stuff. Now, we want workers treated with respect and treated fairly, without a doubt. I was a worker. You know, I want everybody treated fairly. But you can't leave out the taxpayers in this equation either, Paul. And often the taxpayers are forgotten, and we need governors, to regardless of party, to do smart intelligent negotiations that also take care of the taxpayer.
Yeah. So have you heard anything now as to what maybe the sticking points might be or a time frame for this? Again, it's a long time before that election, Frank, but we know how many votes the state employees have either a personal or a familial attachment to.
Yeah, we need to, you know, there's always that equation that the unions carry a lot of power because they carry, you know, they get the people knocking on doors and phone banking and endorsing candidates. But we have to put the public at that bargaining table, too. And the state of unions have betrayed their members and have betrayed the public for years. Mm-hmm. You got to remember the pension crisis in Connecticut. The reason we're in billions of dollars of debt is because the state union officials agreed with politicians, governors from both parties, to underfund the pensions. And we also have health care issues. Every time that we get a governor in there that says they're going to represent the taxpayers, they may move the needle a little, but they don't really negotiate. It seems that the unions are playing chess and the governor's playing checkers. Well, let's just take what people pay into their pensions.
Okay.
A firefighter in our cities, in Hartford and New Haven, they're paying about 12% to their pension.
All right.
So are police officers in Hartford and New Haven. So these are individuals that would make their spouse a widow and their kids parentless for the community they serve. They're paying 12% to their pension, but state workers across the board are paying 3 to 6% into their pension. So, you know, where's the equity in that? If you look at health care across the board, most municipal contracts, even negotiated 6 years ago, workers were paying across the board 14%. Now, in negotiations, you're seeing in town contracts across Connecticut, 17 to 20% is what's being negotiated. So there's some skin in the game for workers and their health care benefits, where it appears that state workers are only paying about 2% of their health care budget. So we need a governor that's going to stick up for the residents of Connecticut, treat employees with respect, but bring some balance back to the bargaining table. The bargaining table's got to be about balancing, Paul. Just how you balance your home.
Yeah.
Your home. You know, I mean, they say, oh, we got this big surplus now, and the unions are saying, use the surplus for this and that. Wait a second. We got a big surplus. That's just saying, hey, I budgeted for my this month at home, and I got a little extra money left over, but you're forgetting to think that you got $100,000 or billions of dollars on the credit card. You know, you didn't really make anything. That money that we have all saved up doesn't even cover all our unfunded liability. Connecticut's got a long way to go.
Yeah, one thing, Frank, I've never understood, and I talked with somebody about this on the show the other day. Look, I understand that state union workers want and expect, frankly, good medical coverage. Nobody's arguing that. But it's interesting that in many of these contracts, they or their spouses get virtually first dollar coverage to the, you know, the day they pass away. Hopefully they have a nice long retirement. But is any aspect, Frank, of what Medicare would pick up there and maybe save the state from having to pay for, is any of that taken into consideration? Because I was just musing with somebody the other day, hey, couldn't we save money, Frank, for example, if instead of paying first dollar for a retiree that who might live a good 20, 25, 30 years after retirement from the state, why doesn't the state just use it as gap coverage if the federal government is there? Am I wrong here? What am I missing?
Tom, I mean, Paul, that's all up for negotiations at the bargaining table.
Uh-huh.
And if you look at most municipal contracts in the state, most municipal employees, they go on Medicare at 65.
Yeah.
And some contracts that are generous cover a supplement until they're 70.
Okay.
But they don't just keep them on the taxpayer's dime indefinitely. It's unsustainable. And, you know, that's the problem at the state. They don't look at it as the taxpayers' money.
Yeah.
They just look at it as a political revenue stream, and that needs to change.
Yeah. Frank Ritchie from the Yankee Institute, yankeeinstitute.org, the labor fellow there. Frank, keep us up to date on this, okay? Appreciate the time.
Thank you, Paul. Have a great day.
Appreciate it, Frank Ritchie. Remember, look up the case Ritchie v. DiStefano, went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. some years ago. Good for Frank. He stuck by his guns. Plenty to talk about with this gentleman. We check in with him, see what's on his mind, what's on his keyboard, what's coming up from him every Wednesday, middle of the week, 5:15. Dan Haar, Hearst Connecticut Media, senior editor and columnist. Mr. Haar, good afternoon, sir. How are you today?
Great. Good afternoon. So it's they said rain is turning to showers. Isn't that what rain is?
Well, I've asked my weather people over the years, Dan, and I guess there is a dividing line between a shower and rain. As there is, Dan, I found out one day from a weather guy I used to work with, there's a dividing line between a breezy day and a windy day, too. So there you
go. Got it. Okay, well, good. I'm glad of that. But so plenty of public policy to talk about. Where do we start?
How about we start with SNAP and the local effort and the national effort? And, Dan, you and I have been around the block a few times of this. Part of this is posturing. We get it. We understand it. Can you envision the SNAP beneficiaries having their EBT cards not work come this Saturday?
I predict that the Democrats are going to cave. And I think that's probably the right thing to do. I hate to say it because I agree with those people who say that what the Republicans are doing. Look, nobody is completely in the right. Mm-hmm. But I generally agree that these benefits should be continued on both the healthcare side and the food side.
Yeah.
And I know that the healthcare side is much more complicated. But I predict that the Democrats are going to listen. If the congressional, it's John Thune soon. If he's smart, he'll give the Democrats a little bit of something, and everybody will look like they settled. Because both sides, as we obviously all know from the polls, both sides are getting the crap beat out of them over this. It looks like it's going to happen. The fortunate thing in Connecticut is there's a pretty sophisticated apparatus of some 600 plus food pantries.
Yeah.
And obviously they're gearing up, and all of our news stories have ways that you can help. And Food Share is robust, and the state is kicking in with its own money, and hopefully it'll work.
Yeah, and Dan, I'm sure you may have a thought on this or two. I don't know whether you saw it, but our friend Tom Dudchick on his side, he posted that rather long and detailed and pretty good piece today about Chris Murphy. And in the piece regarding SNAP, it says, hey, hate Trump or not, despise him or whatever, like it's a constant barrage of his, and Democrats have to make noise somehow. They've got to, as you and I hear this all the time, control the cycle here. And I wonder how much of the SNAP thing, Dan, is an aspect of that. Just, geez, slow the guy down a little. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but it's not working.
Yeah.
It's not working politically. It's not working in respect to policy, and it's not working in respect to people's lives. Mm. So I agree with the Republicans in the narrow sense that the Democrats, look, they've played a hand. This game of chicken, the cars are now 5 feet apart, and somebody's got to swerve. And as the great columnist Thomas Friedman of the New York Times said, you can't out crazy a crazy. Right, and Chris Murphy is not crazy enough to out crazy Trump.
Yeah, and
Trump is crazy. The guy is crazy. He doesn't give a crap about anybody, and he's crazy. He will not swerve that car.
And as I have said, Dan, and I said this past November, people say, "Well, what do you think?" And I said, "Well, America had a choice between the perceptions of crazy on one side and essentially broken on the other side." And they pick crazy because sometimes, crazy wins or gets something right every so often. Let's go to Pura here, one of our favorite subjects here. Before we get to some of the stuff of Pura that may not be going away, Dan Haar, explain what is this UI rate increase? Now, was that planned or is this like a peace offering from the new Pura board? Talk to me about
this. I believe this was a revote on something.
Okay.
Wasn't this the vote? I haven't actually covered it day to day, but wasn't this the vote that got appealed and it got sent back? Isn't this the remanded vote?
I think that might be for $66 million. Yeah.
In any case, this was a split the baby or whatever cliche you want to use. And I find it a little bit disturbing that Attorney General Tong is out there swinging over this when it appears to be the closest thing to an olive branch that we've seen mm-hmm. from Pura. And I think everybody has to just accept that over the years, this looks more like the norm. Right. It is false that over the years under, you know, my friend Art House and under all the other commissioners of Pura, whoever you want to name, that they always just rolled over for the utilities. That's just not true. Right. The most in 2018, for example, only one third of a rate request was given to Eversource. So this looks more like the norm. And you have to accept that just as in health and housing and food, underlying costs of energy are rising, and an 8% increase ain't that you can't ascribe everything to usurious profits by these companies. That's just not that's just not an accurate way of looking at it.
And finally, Dan, as Pura goes here, the legal questions, the kind of soap opera this turned into toward the end, apparently in some aspects that's not over. Is that what we're seeing?
Well, I mean, it's my friend Chris Keating at the Hartford Current, and I give him credit. He FOI'd some documents in which he showed that one lawyer, Pura, was the liaison among many other jobs. He was a legislative liaison or something like that. Mm. He now is petitioned internally in documents that have been FOI'd to no longer report to the general counsel, because he's tying the general counsel to actions of the now exited, vanquished former chair and saying, I don't want to be tarnished by this. So that proves beyond what we already said, which is that this the politics isn't over. I had thought naively that it was really all about policy and that it was more about figuring out a way to make the system work. But apparently it's even worse than that.
What might you be working on that my listeners would be waiting for in the next few days? Anything you got cooking there?
Yes, I think that what I wrote about this week with the threats by a person who's been charged with two felonies, including a hate crime of intimidation against state senators, multiple state legislators, that really raises very, very interesting questions, that case, because this is a person who had ammunition. It is possible that some and guns were confiscated, which you don't see every day. This is a person who said, I'm a peaceful guy. Just because I said reprehensible things doesn't mean that I was going to carry that out. And please note, he said that I did not make direct threats, as in I'm going to kill you. What he said was, this person should have X happen to him. And that X is some of the most horrific stuff I've ever read. And I'm old.
Yeah.
So there's more to come on this story. This is not going away. This environment of threats and what the state does about them is not going away. And people are spooked by this, and rightly I would be if I were the target of what this person wrote. I would be afraid. So there you go.
Yeah, and Dan, you know, doing what I do here, occasionally I get the email or the text message and I say, well, okay, I'm going to flag this one. So thankfully, I've never gotten anything that caustic, but every so often I'm like, well, okay. Dan, we will look for that and that coverage and more. Dan Haar, Hearst Connecticut Media. Dan, be good. Have a great weekend. We'll chat next week. Thank you, sir.
Very good. Have a good weekend.
All right, thanks. Dan Haar, Hearst Connecticut Media.